If you've been told to pull up your socks recently, then make sure it's a pair of RCR socks. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this new show and my first guest. I am so pleased, so excited to have Joanne O with us. She is the representative of the strict title for Joanne is she is the representative of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in New Zealand. But first and foremost, I think of Joanne as a friend and as effectively what I would term the de facto ambassador for Taiwan here in New Zealand, for reasons you'll hear later in this discussion, that tension, that interplay between Taiwan and China changes some of our language we use. But Joanne, it is absolutely marvellous to have you on the show, the first guest. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Simon, my good friend. It's absolutely my honor, a great delight to be in your show, in your program. And I'm looking forward to discussing all this important subject with you and with all our New Zealand audience.
Well, there's so much to talk about. The relationship between New Zealand and Taiwan has been very strong for years, despite a lot of headwinds, and we'll be discussing different elements of that. Obviously, your neighbour to the west, as I refer to Communist China, has caused tensions. There's things we can talk about from your entry into the WHO through to obviously what's happening in the UN, all the intimidation in the Taiwan Strait. There's going to be no shortage, including a new president. So today there is, as I say, lots to discuss. But first and foremost, without sounding too philosophical, who is Joanne O? How did you come to be Taiwan's representative in New Zealand?
Thank you very much, Simon. Yes, I'm a career diplomat, so I've joined the foreign ministry 28 years. I've been posted, was in New York twice, 13 years. And then I became the spokesperson of the foreign ministry, and I was in the position for more than 5 years. And right now I'm very honored and delighted to be posted here in New Zealand to increase the incredible relationship that we have with New Zealand, and knowing that Taiwan is New Zealand's seventh largest trading partner, and that we have signed an FTA, which is called ANSTEC, 11 years ago, doing wonderful our trade. And so 2022 alone, I think our trade volume has reached to 1 billion. New Zealand enjoys steady trade surplus over Taiwan, which is wonderful, and is about $150 million to $300 million US dollars. And the best thing is that we are, partners that we have the shared values of democracy and freedom, and that, you know, both countries, we have this very secure supply chain of democracies, and that, you know, our trade relationship is doing wonderful. And then, you know, we just had the recent development is that, you know, the Taiwan pineapple, you know, which is a symbol of our freedom and prosperity. So it just came to New Zealand on April the 9th, you know, after 8 years of consultation between the teams of our both countries. So Taiwanese pineapple is here in the market. So I'm very delighted. And just to name one of the important products, besides of the many, many products that Taiwanese people would enjoy about New Zealand, you know, from the lamb, from the steak, of course, kiwis, cherries, milk product. So relationship doing great, and it's my duty and my honor to make it stronger and even better. And I'm very happy that, you know, after 11 years of signing our FTAs called ANSTEC, you know, our relationship is better than ever.
Oh, it's an incredibly strong relationship, and I think it's one of the things I would really hope our listeners take away from today, that the New Zealand-Taiwanese relationship is strong, getting stronger. I think a lot of people, Joanne, wouldn't have appreciated that you're our seventh largest trading partner. I mean, that's significant. We're quite dependent on you guys for particularly our semiconductors, and I'm tempted to cut the interview short and go out and get some of that Taiwanese pineapple because it's really good. But we should keep chatting. And actually, while I start on your good self, you very kindly helped facilitate a trip that I had last year to Taiwan, and got to meet a number of really fantastic people. But why I mention it is I had the privilege of sitting down with the then foreign minister, Joseph Wu, for dinner, and he spoke incredibly highly of you as just a person of remarkable skills and talent. So I think it's marvellous that you're here in New Zealand representing Taiwan with us. So great feedback from him, now shared with you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Simon. No, we are grateful to you. And of course, it was our honor and delight to, you know, to invite you to Taiwan for you to see in our country. And we are always grateful to you for helping us to, you know, settle. You are the creator, the founder of the Cross Political Party Parliamentary Group on Taiwan. And, you know, and that was the that was a historical, you know, milestone. It never happened in the Parliament of New Zealand, given all our relationships. But you were the founder, and so you brought all parties together. And you set up the friendship group that today is still working very well. No, so we owe you that. We're grateful to you, and thank you for visiting Taiwan. You know, and so I'm anticipating, you know, many trips of you going to Taiwan, and there are many things we want to continue learning from you, and you know, friends, you know, stay forever, and we look forward to learning from you, Simon.
Well, I'm keen to get back. I'm going to take Rachel with me this time. It's one thing to explain what I saw, but it's a marvellous to be able to take her back at some point. But just for context for listeners, the New Zealand Parliament has lots of friendship groups between countries, but one glaring gap for me was that there was no friendship group between New Zealand and Taiwan. So yeah, I was pleased to set that up, and I'm so relieved and delighted, Joanne, that it's been continued, that colleagues from across the House, both from the left and the right, are part of that friendship group, and it's ongoing. So I think it's just, again, a good sign of the strength of our relationship. And you mentioned, so it was 2013 that we signed a free trade agreement with Taiwan. And as you say, you've grown to the seventh largest now. So Taiwan would take a lot of our dairy products and fruits, I'm assuming?
Yes, yes. So the main product that Taiwanese we love of New Zealand are, you know, the your lamb and especially kiwis, all kind of kiwis, we love it, right? And then dairy product as well. So a lot of agricultural product is going on. And so of course, Taiwan, we're manufacturers of semiconductor products and also the chips. For instance, for the world most advanced chips, we produce around 92%. And for the most of the semiconductor products, we produce 64% of the world supplies. And the whole Taiwan is basically built for semiconductors and high tech. It's basically an ecosystem, you know, of semiconductors and manufacturers of chips, of computer chips. And also, you know, 40% of the sea cargo passes through Taiwan Strait. So that's why we are, you know, there are experts, they already made their analysis in the case of contingencies, if China invades Taiwan, I mean, the cost for the whole world will be more than $10 trillion. It will be the loss for everybody. So that's why, you know, we've been talking that maintaining peace and stability is crucial. It's not only for Taiwan and China, but it's for the whole world, because there's a direct interest, including New Zealand, and that is on the, you know, New Zealand National Interest and National Strategies Report, that most of the countries, they have the direct interest, you know, in Taiwan Strait. We need to secure Taiwan Strait remains as international waters, and there is a freedom of navigation, freedom of passage, you know, that, you know, the 40% of sea cargoes can continue to come and go freely, and using the Taiwan Strait as an international water. We need to secure that there's no military confrontation there, that, you know, differences should be resolved through dialogue only, and that it's not acceptable the use of force, threats, intimidation, and coercion. And in that sense, I want to thank, you know, the, you know, New Zealand government, especially under the leadership of Prime Minister Christopher Laxon, because right now it's the fourth time right now that the coalition government has mentioned in public that that they are supporting, you know, the maintenance of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, opposition to any unilateral changes of status quo. Differences should be resolved through, you know, peaceful means, through dialogue. And there's no acceptable of the use of force, coercion, and military, you know, threats and intimidation. And that we just heard that yesterday from Prime Minister, you know, Christopher Luxon, yesterday in a speech. In his previous speech, he also said that. Also, a very special thanks is to the Deputy Prime Minister and current Foreign Minister, Winston Peters, because he also said, I reiterated that in the Osmin 2+2, we've seen the foreign minister and defense minister of New Zealand when they met with the counterpart with Australia, and then release a joint statement and with a very clear and strong language, calling for peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. And that is exactly, that we are also, calling the world, to urge the maintenance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, because ultimately it's indispensable, it's direct interest to all of us. And then I think it's the best interest to all countries around the world that peace and stability should be maintained, and that there's no excuses to use force when you have dialogue and to resolve the problem.
I think a really important and good summation. A lot of times, Joanne, my sense is Kiwis think of this tension. Well, firstly, Taiwan's a long way away. Secondly, there's these tensions between Taiwan and Communist China. But again, it's distant. But I think you've really highlighted for listeners, and we actually might delve into this more. I was going to actually touch first and foremost on the whole democratic system and your new president, but I think we go down this national security route first. Taiwan is in a critical, literal, physical space in the world. As you say, 40% of cargoes moving through there. But your country faces almost every day provocations and incursions from China. And I think it would be great if listeners could hear a little bit about that, the pressures which are continually there. And ultimately, says me, a real risk, actually, that one day there's going to be a miscalculation or a misunderstanding, because China is regularly sending its Air Force planes into your airspace, maritime craft into your space, which requires interdiction. Just tell us what some of these incursions look like, and if you don't mind, how Taiwan has to respond.
Thank you. So the situation of the tension is really high in Taiwan, and we're trying to do our best to maintain peace and to contain them. China is becoming really aggressive, and so their incursion into the medium line, into our ADIZ, air identification zone, is almost daily. So until now, for instance, until the 30th of August, of April, their incursions already happened 112 days. They're selling 1,214 aircraft, and these numbers are until April 30th. And then there are 450 aircrafts crossing the Taiwan, medium line into our southern west defense identification zone. The balloons they've been sending, to the United States in January alone, they sent 57 to us. And until the present, there's only more than 100. And those are the military aggression, intimidation, and incursions. And that's happening on a daily basis. Besides of that, we can see that there's a lot of, cognitive warfare by, sending disinformation, fake news inserted, in our media, and a lot of infiltration, exactly what happened here, unfortunately also in New Zealand, for instance, back in 2021 to the parliament, to your website, and also the attacks on the MP to yourself, for instance, and to Louisa Wall. So unfortunate, that kind of infiltration is also happening in Taiwan, in most of democracy. We have seen many MPs from democratic worlds coming together, say, hey, this is happening to me, why we're not informed, what we can do to protect ourselves. And that is exactly not only happening in New Zealand, happening in Taiwan, the US, Australia, Canada, European countries, Japan. It's happening with a lot of democracies. And that is kind of a cognitive warfare they're launching. Organized, state sponsored by PLA, the People's Liberation Army. They have the whole team, doing that. And then so they're very targeted, very specified. And so this kind of cognitive warfare is also very important in the espionage. So all this kind of thing, we are bearing that on a daily basis. And so working very hard. And as you rightly pointed out, there's a high risk of misinterpretations when they're coming very close, you know, so you have to really discern, are you invading us? Shall we launch, you know, the missile? Shall we shoot them down? And so those are very, very difficult situations. The latest, what they did is that they just altered overnight three airlines' routes. So they activated a two and altered a one main very close, make it very close to, you know, Taiwan Strait medium line. So, you know, and that is very dangerous. Firstly, totally against, you know, regulations of ICAO, International Civil Organizations, were saying that when you are, you know, changing the route, you know, airline routes, you should consult with related parties. And of course, there's no consultation, not advance, you know, notification to Taiwan, except they, you know, just they launch that, they announce that, you know, in the evening and saying this is going to in effect next morning. So it's so disrespectful, but not only to us, but to the life of millions of passengers that we affected by these three, you know, airline routes. And also, and I think that it's things like that. China has been doing that, and so it has been incredible, very, very provocative. And so, from our end, we're trying to do very best, you know, to hold that, and to balance that, to respond to that in an appropriate way. But sometimes it's very hard because they just keep doing that, and they're very provoking, they're very aggressive, you know, and so they're launching a lot of new measures that it's really endangering the life of passengers. And here, you know, just to share with you that there are around 72 million passengers coming to Taiwan, transiting to Taiwan, you know, you're just using, you know, Taiwan Airport, which we have 86 international airline companies. They are on the ground in Taiwan. We are the hub of East Asia, and from Taiwan you can go to 110 cities around the world, and the number is increasing. From New Zealand and Australia alone, the passengers, more than 580,000, you know, Australian and New Zealanders, they will travel to Taiwan as a visitor, or, you know, for doing business or doing just transit in Taiwan. And so from here, for instance, we have several companies that do, you know, direct flight, connecting flight. One of them is Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand does three direct flights per week. And then this is from direct Auckland to Taipei, direct flight, 11 hours, three times a week. And there's a very intense, the transit of international passengers coming to Taiwan or transiting to Taiwan. So when China is, you know, altering this, you know, changing this fly routes, is really, really dangerous and endangering the life of millions of passengers of many, many countries.
Well, as you're saying, it's just part of that interference, that cognitive or grey area warfare, which they're practicing. And again, I think, you know, people listening in to this need to understand that the real tensions which are playing out every day. And as you said, Joanne, it's not simply planes crossing the air defence lines, maritime vessels, all that disinformation. We saw a lot of that during your recent presidential campaign. We'll have to come to, not yours, sorry, Taiwan's presidential campaign. It's multi-leveled, and then you get these unilateral decisions. And for people to understand, you know, airlines go through a system to discuss where their planes can fly. Air New Zealand's part of that, as are all airlines. And yet China just arbitrarily and unilaterally says, no, you can't use these routes now. And it's all designed, isn't it, to put more and more pressure on Taiwan. And it's also not so subtly trying to say that Taiwan's not a real country, is not a real player. It's trying to dismiss you, which I find terrible and very, very frustrating. But I think you've kept bringing home to us, Joanne, like, you're a significant player, a major hub, a major transport hub into Asia. And I'm glad you mentioned Air New Zealand up there three times a day, because it also reminds me, you've got China Airways. Here's a curiosity for New Zealanders. When you're at Auckland Airport and you see the China Airways planes, they're actually of Taiwan, because Taiwan's official name is the Republic of China. So, yeah, the China Airways is a Taiwanese airline. And they're great, by the way. It's what I travelled with last year to get up to Taipei.
Yes. So yes, they are. Yes, that was funny because they are like two airline companies, very similar names, but from different source. You know, from Taiwan is China Airlines, and that is definitely Taiwanese. And we have another is called EVA Airlines. And then from their side, I think they started, and their name is Air China, and that is very PRC. And so it's very, very, very confusing names. But remember, for the China Airlines, go with the flowers. You know, so we have a flowers there. And just double check, is that from Taiwan or from China? You can tell a difference by yourself.
But I think, again, listeners, just a good understanding of the daily pressures which the people of Taiwan are experiencing. And one of the things I was struck with, Joanne, talking to your foreign minister and to President Tsai at the time, this is very real. So for me down here, even though I'm really interested in these topics, it's distant, if you will, but the real present imminent threat was very much on their mind. And even as you travel around parts of the country, it's clear that the threats from China are not just, they're not just idle threats. Maybe that's the question in behind my statement, is the people of Taiwan see the statements coming out of communist China as real tangible threats that have to be addressed. Is that right?
Yes, you're exactly right, Simon. You know, so the threats is daily, and it's very real. That is on our daily, you know, basis. What we are trying to do, you know, as a Taiwanese, is that we're trying to cope with it. And so we're trying to, you know, having like business as usual, a normal life, you know, so our economy is still, you know, thriving, still prospering. During the COVID time, we're able to still maintain 3.14% of economic growth, you know, COVID time. And under COVID time, for instance, and that is related also to WHO. So we are trying to, you know, adopt measures of our own in order so for our economy to keep thriving and our people not being affected, you know, by virus. So we're working very hard. And in terms of defense capabilities, so what we're trying to ask ourselves is, are we well prepared? Are we well prepared now? What are the defense reforms it needs to be done? So in case of contingencies, is our troops, are they capable of combat, you know? And so how is the people well prepared? And so these days we're changing our mindset into developing, you know, an asymmetric combat capabilities, you know, reforming our, you know, our troops and our armed forces and also, so, you know, increasing our operational efficiency, you know, between the forces, increasing also, we propose to increase also our budget to 3%. Currently is 2.5%. So we're trying to do at 3% to 3.5%. We are extending, you know, our military service to 1 year, you know, thanks to an advice from United States. We're doing some reforms in our conscriptions, our military service. We're enlarging our reserve, you know, people. So we're upgrading our military training, you know, doing more international military cooperations with minded countries, exchanging and sharing informations, and also enlarging, deepening, and broadening the civil defense capabilities. So the question we are facing, you know, besides of trying to contain any provocation, you know, aggression, not to let it become a conflict, but also is to raise, you know, our awareness and our preparedness, how well we're prepared, changing our mindset, and also the arms sales, you know, the procurement of our weapons. So instead of purchasing this large piece of tank, so right now we are purchasing, you know, like a smaller, lightweighted, better equipped, technological speaking, that can raise the rate of survival in case of combat. So there's a whole change of mindset that we're learning. We are thinking about the best way. When we are smaller, much smaller, and then we're facing a much larger, aggressive country. So what we can best do to prepare ourselves? So this day we're very much thinking about that, you know, about reforms, it's also changing the mindset, the defense concept capabilities, and develop these asymmetric combat capabilities.
And I think my observation, again, as an outsider, and again for listeners, is to understand that this is a real threat. So what, you know, you're discussing here, Joanne, about 3%+ of your GDP being spent on defence, military service. This has all been done because there's a real existential threat. And again, it's just something New Zealanders, I think, need to appreciate, because we are very fortunate to be down here so far away from anyone. But what you're facing is incredibly real. And, you know, one of many things is that Taiwan is a vibrant, functioning democracy. In fact, you're a relatively new democracy. You know, the history of Taiwan had seen a lot of, well, an autocratic rule. I hope that's the right word to use, for a while. But you've now embraced democracy, and it's incredibly vibrant. In fact, if you don't mind, for listeners' sake, how long has Taiwan been a democracy?
Yes, no, that's a good question. We are fairly recent democracy. You're thinking like during the Cold War, because of the context, we were a dictatorship ourselves, right? We're talking, you know, from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and, you know, in the late 80s. So we used to have the longest martial law of the whole world for 38 years, you know, and so our country was governed by the Generalissimo, you know, Chiang Kai-shek, which was, you know, name is Generalissimo. So it's always the right wing. As such, we were a dictatorship ourselves. So the reform came very slow. The democratic reform came costly. So a lot of people, the struggle and even sacrifice their life for. So that's why today we cherish so much our democratic, you know, system and our freedom and our way of life, which we're not going to give in by anything in the world. And that is something we're not going to yield into, you know, China. It doesn't matter, you know, about the pressure, intimidation, aggression we talk about, the yield on does, because the more aggressive they become, actually that reinforce our determination to even defend better our democracy, you know, protect our human rights, you know, our freedom, our way of living, because we sacrifice so much to achieve what we have today. In the late 80s, we started a little bit the process, you know, because it's always hard to change from authoritarian to open it up a little bit and allowing opposition party to form. That was during the late 80s. And then during the early 90s, so we start, you know, having this discussion of having a real election, a general election, that people can really vote in secrecy, universal vote, and that you don't have to be afraid if you're casting the vote for the opposition. A real election. And that took us until, that didn't even realize that until 1995, 1996, when we first had our free election. And then, you know, the former president, Dr. Lee Teng-hui, he passed away now. He was elected and he was being called Mr. Democracy. And so when we had our first direct election in 1995, and so also China was, well, that's when they started sending all the missiles, you know, across, just to intending to threaten us. But for us, it's like, you know, that really reinforced, you know, people's will. If the more missiles, the more intimidation, you know, they're sending, so that's a guarantee that the opposition is going to get elected, you know. So that is actually usually sometimes is very counterproductive for them, just to threaten us, you know, during the election times and, you know, and in general. So, you know, so we are a fairly recent democracy, far from being perfect. And you can see, you know, right now there's a lot of contingencies and body languages and fighting in our parliament.
Yes, powerful. I was wondering to even raise that with you. I was struck when visiting Taiwan that actually the Taiwanese people are not afraid to talk about their history and where you've been, but yes, the pride in their your democratic structures. Now people are really, really proud of that. But yeah, I was struck there was a bit of a fist fight or something in your parliament. I mean, clearly passionate people.
Yes, I think they're too passionate for democracy, and that is when I think we need to learn, we need to mature, frankly speaking. But and also show how passionate, you know, and the pressure of different political parties and the insistence, you know, of the, you know, different political parties. Right now, they're talking about whether they should pass this. There's some regulations that called, you know, disdain to the parliament, you know, contempt to the parliament, and but by that it means that when, you know, you're being questioned, or and you have to be, you know, very frank in, you know, telling whatever you have, submitting all the documents. And obviously, because of our situation, many of the documents are confidential and sensitive by nature. And so that's one of the debate, you know, how transparent we should be when we are facing, you know, the questioning from the parliament, especially when there are matters of confidentiality. The matter probably perhaps better for closed doors, you know. So that's one of the debates we are having. And as you can see, they've been very, very passionate, mobilization, the whole mobilization. And so it's part of the democracy. We're young democracy, so we're still learning, but it's a true democracy for sure. And right now, as you know, the president, we just had our new president, and the ruling party, which is DPP, they had this unprecedented third term as the, in the presidency. Not the same person, right? Dr. Tsai Ing-wen, she had her 8 years, she did a great job, and right now from May 20th she retired, right? So we have who was the vice president, he got elected as the president, and right now he's starting the third term. So in terms of the presidency, it's a victory for the ruling parties, they have the third term, but in the parliament the opposition got the majority, right? So we are presidential system, so that is one of the challenges they're facing in the parliament. Like, it's real as well, you know, the fight are real, because we got the majorities, the opposition took it for one seat, plus they made alliance or coalition with a third party force, which they got 8 seats. So right now they have the majority in the parliament. And so basically, and so if we go by voting, they can pass any, you know, laws and regulations that they want. So so then we enter another arena as well of when is, just like the president, he said that in his inaugural speech. So when you have the majority, so you have to set also a boundary to respect the minority. So it's about mutual respect. It's about concession. It's about an art of still being polite when you have so such a huge difference in the bills that you're introducing that, you know. And so, no, Taiwan, I think we are very transparent. We're very frank, you know, to address our flaws. And so obviously, you know, our parliament, they have still a lot to learn from.
Don't worry, New Zealand. New Zealand still got its issues. You would have seen what happened in our parliament a few weeks ago with an MP crossing the floor and getting quite aggressive. Not quite a full-on fight, but New Zealand doesn't hold a moral high ground in this space. But I just thought it was, dare I say, I just found it quite fascinating, having only just been in the parliament. You're right, people are passionate. There's passionate ideas. And you've got a fascinating system or situation now, a president from one party, but as you say, your parliament is a majority of the other party. So it's going to be, well, fascinating to see how that works out. But talk us through, because you've just had your new president inaugurated. I met with the previous president, Tsai Ing-wen, an amazing woman. Dare I try to describe over radio, but quite a diminutive, quite a smaller in stature lady, but my lord, a wonderful intellect, insight, and just, I remember the hour I spent with her, just incredible discussion. And I think, says me, China and others underestimated her. But her time's come to an end, and you now have a new president inaugurated on the, was it the 20th? Yeah, the 20th of May, so only a few days ago. Yes. So tell us about your new president. Who is he?
Yes, our new president, Dr. Tsai, is like Lai Qingde, William Lai. He's actually a son of the coal miner. He comes from very, very humble family, like, you know, his family was struggling even, you know, to find food on the table. And so he put himself up and become a medical doctor, you know, by his own effort. And so he was a very successful doctor. Afterwards, you know, in during our democratic process, so he launched into election, and so he became MP as well in our parliament, outstanding MP. And so later he became became governors of Tainan, which was called, it's in the, you know, in the central south part of Taiwan, which we call them the city of democracy. And so he was so successful. So then, you know, people were saying that, you know, you should be running for something higher. And so he later became our prime minister. And then afterwards, he became the vice minister, the vice president. And right now he's elected as the president and just inaugurated, as you rightly point out, in May 20th, just now on Monday. And here I also must, you know, give a credit to, you know, the former president, Dr. Tsai Ing-wen. As you say, yeah, she's a lady, but she's one of the brightest, you know, mind we ever had. And also she was an expert on trade negotiations. So very well training her whole career on that. She is somebody's like really standing hold on her principles and very resilient to all kind of pressures. So really China underestimated her. So she was able to hold up everything and, you know, still put the country together during the COVID and under such threats, and that today we had this, you know, still a thriving democracy and economy. So no, she right now she has done her job, 8 years accomplished. And, you know, she waved her hands. She's retiring right now. But as part of democracy, that's part of beauty. You know, when your time comes, you give up power and you give up the power, you know, to the next one who won't. The power through democratic means, right? And so our new president, Dr. Lai Qingde, William Lai now. So he just mentioned some of the very important thing on his inaugural speech. He mentioned, for instance, right now we're going to, you know, promote the, you know, the national project of hope. He says that we should always, you know, have hope into maintaining peace and stability of the country of the Taiwan Strait. It's hope, but not illusion. You know, so we have to discern that, you know, when it's possible and when it's not possible. And so when it's not possible, how well are we prepared to do that? And so for the policies for the country, he mentioned the four pillars of peace, right? So first, as we discussed as well, is strengthen the national defense. And that is to enhance our asymmetric combat capabilities that we talk about, and that we continue to do that. And second also is to prove our economic security, that we do have, you know, economic growth and all that. But I think it's important how to, you know, ensure that we have this secure supply chain, you know, between democracies, whereas as COVID, you know, time, we all knew that there are some key element from the supply chain was missing, and they were holding, you know, by authoritarian regimes. And so right now, democracies, we need to hold this key element in our hands and help each other. So the economic security is very important, and we will continue to commit to develop our high tech, you know, our semiconductors, and to be an important role in this global chain of secure supply chain.
If you don't mind me asking there, sorry to jump in, we should get to the, be good to hear all four, but actually how is Taiwan's economy doing? You know, New Zealand's struggling at the moment. How is Taiwan's economy? Is it ticking along strongly or is it slowed down a little bit? What's happening there?
Well, right now, during the COVID time, we're still having the 3.14% of our economic growth. And today we're talking about raising the salary of public servants or public functionaries by 4%. Because during this COVID time, we didn't have a salary raise. So right now we're doing only that 4%. But it shows that the economy is increasing, you know, steady, slowly, but increasing. So I would be very proud to say, you know, our economy, we're doing well despite of the challenges that we all have COVID time. And one of the things that COVID time is because we discovered the virus very early stage, right? Like in December of 2019, we're the first one, actually, we're the first country to report us that, you know, there's something coming from Wuhan. This is a kind of new coronavirus, is highly infectious. And so we alerted WHO saying, you have to be very careful on this. This is highly alerted. But our warm was ignored. And so WHO sent us, they said, well, no, you are not yet WHO, you know, as a member or observer, so you go back and talk to China. And we're telling them, we reported something from China, so you should issue alerts to the whole world, you know. And so if WHO had listened to us, you know, perhaps really many innumerable lives would have been saved, you know. And so since we were ignored by WHO back in 2019, what we did is that, you know what, we're going to do our own measure. So we closely, very quickly, we close ourselves and capsule ourselves in a bubble. And so we start, you know, inspecting every plane coming here. You have to go do your own testing. And after 10 days, we call the first, you know, COVID positive on the airplane from one of the Chinese tourists coming to Taiwan. And of course, the plane was confined at the airport, and we treat them, isolated them, you know, the patient. And then when they're healed, we send them back to China, of course. But that thanks to the measure, we're able to protect ourselves. So in the early stage, when the world was having, you know, alpha and you know, beta and gamma, you know, because the virus mutate. And that the early stage was very dangerous. Those sort of deadly, you know, mutations. We were relatively safe. So we were not. We were always having very isolated, very, very, very few cases. We're able to track each one of them, all the chains, you know, being treated, you know, the whole system. So anyone, we had one case. So we do all this chain system, the whole family system, and all of them has to be, you know, under medical surveillance. So that was we were able to do in the first 1 year and a half, 2 years. So after when they mutated into Omicron, that's when we decided, okay, this is kind of like a flu. So now we're opening the world, we do that, and having this, let's say, collective immunity. So we hadn't have that. And so, well, of course, we all got shot, you know, 5 or 6 times. But in the early stage, you know, we are not part of the WHO, and the vaccine we purchased was delayed. And so we couldn't get the vaccine. And here we must thank Japan and United States, because they sent us free shipping, each one of them. Japan sent us 4.2 million of AZ vaccine freely given, and United States gave us 4 million of vaccines. And so we at the first stage, we have 8.2 million, and then we also develop our own vaccine. And so today, you know, so our Taiwanese vaccine equally effective. We're very proud to say that. And so then we're no problem, you know, getting everybody vaccinated. And also we were also able to also help other countries, you know, with vaccines and with masks. There were times that even, you know, the facial mask, something as simple as that, was also solicited, because we realized that, you know, we got all the mask production in China, not in Taiwan. So we quickly build it up like 9 lines and said, no, we're going to produce our own mask now. And so we're able to certify ourselves, help other countries, you know, we send out like 54 million masks on the early stage. And so we would still want to contribute, you know, with the world. And that is when, you know, when we're talking about, you know, the WHO coming up right now on next Monday, actually May 27, that, yeah. You know, that today we're talking about, you know, pandemic agreement. So they're thinking about if there's a new pandemic coming, so how can the world be prepared? And so everybody has to be on board, you know. So if when you are not allowing Taiwan with its technology, with its contributions, and then with our, you know, our experiences that we're willing and able to share, and then you are letting Taiwan out of that, and so you want to talk about inclusive pandemic, you know, agreement, and so there's a geographical gap there, and so it's very dangerous. And so, you know, disease, they recognize non-political boundaries. And so when you're talking about building an effective global prevention network, so no one should be left behind, you know. And so if you have a geographical vacuum as you're leaving Taiwan out because of political consideration, it's very dangerous for the whole world, right?
We should tease that out a little bit more, because for some listeners, they won't. The World Health Organization is quite controversial to a degree, actually, Joanne, down here with New Zealand, including, you know, whether this global body should be affecting our decision-making around treaties and so forth. But I think there's really two points to draw out for listeners, and let's talk about the WHO and Taiwan. Is first and foremost, how the World Health Organization treated you. As you say, Taiwan early on is saying, hey, there's an issue, and yet this global body, if I heard you right, ignored those warnings. And the second side for listeners to understand is Taiwan is not allowed to be, or has not been let in to be, part of the World Health Organization. And I understand, you know, listeners will have a variety of views on the World Health Organization, but actually, if it's going to operate, then all parties, all groups should be part of it. But Taiwan's been excluded because of political, as Joanne's saying, political reasons. China, Communist China, doesn't want them there. And despite Taiwan identifying these pandemic issues or these health issues early, having their technologies, and you know it better than I do, Joanne, you had some of the best results, if you will, or the best management of the likes of COVID, and yet you're not allowed to share that information into the WHO. You're not allowed to participate. So that's one of the critical issues at the moment, isn't it? Taiwan's excluded, and so there will be a fresh push this month and next for you to join. Is that right?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Simon. Yeah, you know, Taiwan was invited as an observer from 2008 to 2016. And during that time when we were in the WHO, you know, they have the assembly called WHA, right, the World Health Assembly, we participated actively and we made contributions. And then we also report, and we also shared our resources, and so we were very, very active. And so right now, what happened is, as you already pointed out, it was excluded because of the political, the reasons. And then today, during the COVID time, one of the reasons we were relatively successful also is to build the trust between the government and the people, which is always very, very difficult, because in a pandemic time, we need to do medical tracking. And so when you do medical tracking, there's an area of personal information and privacy. So you have to respect the privacy when you're doing the medical tracking and all that. So there was a partnership between government, independent NGOs, medical doctors, and also our people. And so we use this big data, medical surveillance system, and also artificial intelligence, and to pull up to all together. And we were holding like press conference every day at 2 p.m. And so everybody is able to participate to give a feedback. And so we are adjusting that all the time. And so those are valuable experiences we're willing to share.
I imagine that would have been even more of a tension. Like, New Zealand had real tensions around this, and for many of us, sort of government overreach, actually, into our lives. But I imagine this was even more sensitive in Taiwan, having come out of a dictatorship where elements of your lives are highly controlled. I imagine Taiwanese were very sensitive but cautious around this, and therefore wanting to discuss all these steps and mitigations quite carefully.
Yes, you're right. We had that past, from the 70s and 80s. So when we all, for instance, we all have to wear the mask, wearing a mask, compulsory wearing a mask, could be itself an issue, because then you enter to like a personal liberties and then protecting your life, So there was a very big debate. And so at the end, also the medical surveillance system, wherever you go, you use your iPad, or your cell phone. And so there's a code. So you basically have to scan your code. And one of the reasons is that if something happens, we can track you and to notify you who you were in contact and that person was test positive. And so you have to take some preventive, measures for yourself. And so, but that can be achieved in our experience. That can still be achieved when there is proper communication from the government to the people, and then you're allowing proper feedback. So people will come back with you, yeah, that's right, but I feel this away, and here are the recommendations I want. And so we keep modifying, our medical surveillance system, our big data, how to use, artificial intelligence, and also everything we recorded, we erase it very quickly, 24 hours, and we'll be in communication with the people that we use the personal data saying, hey, we have this is for medical service, medical purposes, medical tracking system, and let us know if you're not happy about that. So it requires a lot of effort in communicating individually with each one of the public. So the messaging system was very important. We learned that. And so when there's a proper messaging and communication system taking place, people can trust the government incredibly. So, during the normal time, people will always criticize the government, they will always protest and know that. But incredibly under the pandemic, when there's really a daily communication with the people, with the public. And of us, you know, to our surprise, like, you know, the people of Taiwan, 24 million we're talking about, they reacted and they really behaved. They were like, yes, right now it's, you know, under extremely times. And, you know, I trust that, you know, you are recording of the places I'm going. And I know that is for medical surveillance purpose. So that was able to, you know, to establish. And it was also a very valuable experience for us. But unfortunately, today we are still excluded, so there's a lot of resources we can do, donations we can make when we're not allowed to, and on an annual basis, despite our, you know, our experts, maybe 6 or 7 events they can participate. But there's always, you know, cases of, you know, of boycott and, you know, pressure from, you know, from the communist China, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's scandalous, to be honest. I'm a great believer in more speech and more engagement, and, you know, all countries in the world, particularly if we want to talk about our World Health Organization, then all voices should be held there. And it worries me when actually they're trying to develop protocols and treaties for across the globe that they're still actively excluding the likes of Taiwan. And, you know, even as you were talking around how the people of Taiwan responded, it's quite different to how New Zealand responded. You know, trust here in government and health authorities has declined because of the way things were managed and our own information mismanaged. But I was also struck in your recent elections, there was quite a concerted effort by the CCP, by the Chinese Communist Party, to influence. And actually, Taiwan showed a great ability to actually manage that disinformation. And I'm one of the first people, Joanne, to be very careful around labelling misinformation, disinformation, who makes these decisions. But really importantly, the very clear, deliberate strategy by Communist China was foiled. Taiwan, both through government but also civil society, was able to isolate that so that you had a free and properly democratic election. I think that's fantastic and something we can all learn from.
Well, you're very kind. We're still learning, and it comes with a high cost. You know, back in 2018, we didn't know what was disinformation. We didn't understand what is the cognitive warfare means, right? And so people these days, we are all, you know, finding information from our cell phones, from our iPad, and people would just forward to whatever they thought, and it was up. But we have to learn something. Like the things you're saying, the news you're saying, it could be just fake, you know, and it could be so much we said, this is not even fake news. It would be very disrespectful to, you know, reporters. This is disinformation. It's something combined. You know, something fake is something not even real news. And so then we have the first thing, when we realize that, then we have to enhance our media literacy. And our media literacy education these days, and they start from, you know, the primary school. So we're telling the kids, you know, when you have browsing everything, double check with the sources, always question that, have independent thinking, check with governmental entities, talk to your parents, talk to your teachers, you know, talk to your friends, you know, corroborate the veracity of the news that you are seeing. And that has something to start. We had to start that, you know, learning that from zero back in 2018. Because the infiltration level that we're receiving, you know, from the Chinese Communist agents are massive. And so that changed even, the results of our midterm election. And so we have to be very, very careful. And so we were, you know, really shocked about the degree of disinformation and cognitive warfare that have been launching. These are very well organized. It's state-sponsored, you know, and then they could fake something, they can create something, make it, you know, merge that with what we call the deep fake, this artificial news that really look like real, but they are not real. Those are false. Those are fake thing. And so we have to be very careful when we are, you know, playing with, you know, AI, with this deep fake, you know, information thing. And, you know, besides the coercions, you know, that we have to. And so the internally, we need to guarantee, we need to discern what are the real news, have independent critical thinking. And so if we cannot do that, then that really, the infiltration and the disinformation, the launching, that could actually change the result of our election. And that's very, very dangerous. So we're still learning from that. It's very hard way, and there's in many cases the student on the legal in the court, you know. So but more and more people are having more awareness of what is disinformation, cognitive warfare, and having this being alerted, you know, of what could be really a fake and produced and manufactured, you know, by state sponsor foreign countries.
Well, I think that's where New Zealand is. It's probably hard for many to conceptualize that the Ministry of State Security, that's a communist Chinese entity, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of agents working. The scale of this cognitive or disinformation is phenomenal. But again, I think it's, Joanne, something that New Zealanders can learn from is actually from Taiwan, is of how this is being managed. And as you say, just teaching people to think critically, to take information from all sources and just go, well, what is the source here? Where is this coming from? We sort of got inculcated with, you only have to think this way. It's one of the great problems, I think, in New Zealand, rather than actually that broader thinking. Hey, I'm conscious of time, but a couple of other things we should quickly touch on is, we talked at the start about our trading relationship. As I say, we're significant trading partners, but there's something in the background New Zealanders will know, or you know about it too, of course, but the CPTPP, so this multilateral agreement that New Zealand has with a number of nations, and Taiwan wants to be part of, well, you want to be part of that, I understand, which is great.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. Yes, well, given the great relationship we have, you know, with New Zealand, we signed the FTA, you know, 1 million, you know, the trade volume and all the supplies, of course. And this kind of great relationship we only not have with New Zealand, but we also have it with all of the 12 members that currently CPTPP, you know, comprehensive Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, this very important regional agreement they're having. And so, yes, we submitted our application back in 2021 in September. And so we deposited actually to New Zealand, because New Zealand was the depository, you know, of the treaty, of the agreement. And New Zealand was also last year, 2023, chaired of the whole CPTPP system. And congratulations to New Zealand, because it really did a good job, and one of the very important is the Auckland principles that it laid out, right? And this year it is going to be Canada, which is chairing, and so hopefully they can agree into one mechanism to review the applicants. And currently there are six applicants that submitted who wishes to become part of it. The CPTPP was originally TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was originally promoted by United States, but unfortunately later they withdrew, right? So and so for in order to enter TPP or CPTPP, Taiwan, we amended a lot of laws and to make sure we already reached to the standard, the high standard of CPTPP. And also another of the requirement is that you have to show there's a good record of your commitment to international trade system. And so we, you know, Taiwan, we were a former member of the WTO World Trade Organizations, you know, since 2001. And so, you know, more than 24 years has demonstrated, you know, our record, impeccable record of being friends with everybody and, you know, able to, you know, have this trade great relationship and, you know, being faithful to the international trade commitment, that the record, we're totally okay with that. And so right now we're talking to all the members, you know, to reach the consensus element, or 12 of them. And so hopefully for Canada this year, there's a mechanism about how to review, you know, the six applicants, and to hopefully to set up, we are calling for individual working group to be set. And then so that when we can start with all the further negotiation, further review and further questioning. So last year, one of the advancements, one of the big results under New Zealand leadership was the United Kingdom. So they entered, right? They exited to CPTPP. And that's a very, very good thing. The UK was this, you know, size of economy. And so they have really deserved a place in the CPTPP. So let's hope, finger crossed for this year under Canada leadership. Let's hope that a system can be established about how we're going to do with these six applicants right now. Mm-hmm. Well, currently,
oh, I think it's going to be important. You know, we already trade with Taiwan. You obviously trade with a lot of nations, and yeah, this is a big trade agreement. I can say, having put on a former hat looking after foreign affairs, defence and trade, that actually you meet the criteria, and you know, more trade is better. Hey, two last things, Joanne, because I've held you for a long, long time. Yep. We were talking before we came on radio about a UN resolution, 27R58. This is possibly more for the academic-minded, but a fairly significant UN resolution that's often misrepresented about what it did and didn't do around which countries recognise mainland or communist China versus the Republic of China, or as we know it, Taiwan. Just can you give us a brief summation of what that UN resolution's about, and again, how it's been distorted, I would argue?
Yeah, thank you for raising that, Simon. It's a really important issue. We know that the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 2758, it was passed in the Cold War. It was 1971, October 25th, to be precise. And the background of that is, in the Cold War, you know, Taiwan, Republic of China by then, and the People's Republic of China was the Communist China. They were fighting over, for 22 years, the seat of who is representing the seat of China in United Nations. And after, in the Security Council, because we were the founding member and we hold a seat at the Security Council with veto power. And so the whole question was battled for 22 years. And so at the end, 1971, it passed a resolution basically saying that, you know, the Communist China, they are right now the legal representation of the China government. Okay, so it means that, okay, Taiwan will lose, so we retreat from UN system. That's why we are today. But what that resolution didn't mention at all is that Taiwan belongs to People's Republic of China, because the whole resolution was debating about who represents the whole China, which they took it, and it's fine. So what right now, the Communist China, PRC, is really distorting, you know, the content of the resolution, because not many people, they will go back to find the files of 1971 and really check with that. But if you do and you read the whole narrative, it's all about who represents China. There's not even a word saying Taiwan belongs to China, or Taiwan belongs to People's Republic of China, or Taiwan cannot participate the United Nations, or 24 million of Taiwanese people cannot enter the UN even having our passport. This is exactly what United Nations Secretariat is doing. They are forbidden, you know, Taiwanese people with Taiwan passport holders to enter the UN, even to visit the UN. And our reporters, Taiwanese reporters, they cannot enter the UN just to make a report, you know, just to cover the news. So what the United Nations Secretary is doing is really runs against the United Nations Charter already of, you know, we the people, that everybody can enjoy the UN. And China is also distorting a lot of the content, saying that the so-called One China principle. And so they're distorting the way, saying, okay, right now we are representing the whole China, and, you know, Taiwan is part of China, and therefore Taiwan is part of PRC. And that is so wrong. Logically speaking, that is so wrong. You know, so I think New Zealand, United States, Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, most of democracies, you have your own One China policy, and then which is very different from this One China principle they are claiming. So the One China principle is coming from this distortion of this United Nations 2758 resolution. They're claiming, well, oh yes, now, you know, so you recognize that, you know, that Taiwan is part of PRC. But it's very wrong. If Taiwan were part of PRC, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be speaking like that, right? So we wouldn't exist, but we do. We just elected our president, he just inaugurated. So what they're claiming is wrong. And so we all have to be very careful. So what New Zealand has is New Zealand's One China policy. And that is in your joint communique that you signed with China in 1972. New Zealand did not recognize China's claim on Taiwan. New Zealand only took note, only understand, only acknowledges what China is saying, but not necessarily agreeing with them. It's not agreeing with them. And that is most of the democracies, you know, from 193 countries around the world, only around 57 countries did took China's version of one China principle. Most of the, you know, we're talking the rest of democracy, more than 130 countries saying, no, I understand what you're saying. I take note, you know, I acknowledge what you're saying, but I don't necessarily, I don't agree. I don't recognize that you said Taiwan is part of PRC. And that is very fundamental difference, because in a moment, if China invades Taiwan and you recognize that Taiwan is part of China, so basically there's nothing you can say or you can do because you recognize that. And that is most of the countries, one more 130 countries in the world, they don't agree with that. So they only said, oh, what you're saying, I understand, but I don't agree with you.
And I think that's a really important point, because you always hear in New Zealand media about the one China policy, and you've nailed it, Joanne, which is New Zealand and other countries accept what Communist China says to the, well, Communist China says there's one China, which includes Taiwan.
Yeah.
We go, oh, well, right. we understand that's what you're saying, but as you really importantly point out, we don't necessarily agree with that. In fact, we don't agree with that. We recognize there's China. We recognize there's a democracy of 24, 25 million people called Taiwan. But I think the other element is, it won't surprise listeners around the UN that things get twisted and distorted. You know, Taiwan exists. You exist as, as I keep saying, a vibrant democracy. And one of the reasons we keep quite a close eye on what's happening, not just because of trade, not just because of our relationships, but we recognise a country that shares lots of values. And that's perhaps the last little curiosity we might add, is listeners may not know that actually Taiwan and New Zealand, if you will, culturally related, particularly through the Maori and Melanesian and Pacifica community, the Austronesian relationship there was something I learned when I got to visit last year. So, yeah, this Austronesian relationship links Taiwan deeply into the Pacific.
Yes, yes. So thank you for that. We actually do share the same root. We like to say we are the same whakapapa, you know, with our Maori brothers and sisters. So there are scientific research that shows that, you know, so originally a lot of, you know, Taiwanese indigenous, they went through all around the world. And so one of them, you know, they're deeply related with the Maori brothers and sisters. And so much that, you know, in our, we have 16 indigenous tribe in Taiwan, going to be 18 to are being, you know, recognized. So they're independent nations, you know, within Taiwan. So we fully respect their autonomy, you know, and they have their own language, you know, and they also have mokos, you know, just like here in Maori people, but we have it in our cheeks. They have two tribes. Basically, you have to be like high priest and high witch in order to have tattoos on your face. So, but that shows the similarity of, you know, of culture. And this time when, you know, in April, there are like six MPs from four different political parties that visit Taiwan. The first thing we did is that we visit Ataya. We visit one of the indigenous tribe. And you know, some of them, you know, they have Pacific origins. So they check that there's a lot of customs that are still the same than the Maori people here. So it's wonderful to recognize that the connection, you know, the same whakapapa between Taiwanese indigenous and Maori, our Maori brothers and sisters here. So much that, you know, 11 years ago when we signed our FTA, we call UNSTIG, we have dedicated one special chapter, chapter 19, to dedicate to improve, you know, Maori and indigenous affairs. So the indigenous affairs is kind of like cross-cutting through all the chapters of our indigenous and, you know, welfare and of our NSTEC chapters. So one of the goals we're talking, you know, is to how to improve more, you know, for, you know, between connection between Maori enterprises, Maori business with Taiwanese indigenous, you know, business. And no, that's something to celebrate, you know, Taiwan and New Zealand and Australia and Canada, we are also four countries of IPEDCA, you know, the Indigenous, you know, Cooperation and Economic, you know, Trade Agreement. So that is an agreement that four countries, we do have a number of indigenous recognize their contribution. And we are thinking about how to do more international cooperations. So our indigenous, you know, they can meet their brothers and sisters, you know, with New Zealand, with Australia, with Canada, with Taiwan. It's really beautiful to see that connection
I think it's great. And again, from my trip last year, even being able to recognize some of the language similarities the etymologies are related, which is fantastic. Yes. And I think it's just another illustration, Joanne, of just these strong relationships between New Zealand and Taiwan. So look, thank you so much for giving us the time you have. I know you're incredibly busy as you represent Taiwan here in New Zealand. So to give us all this time to talk us through everything from national security to the notions of the United Nations and the World Health Organization, as we said, trade, interference activities, and obviously the relationship between our cultures. We've covered a lot. We've covered a lot. So a big, big thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you to you, my dear friend. You know, it's always my pleasure and my honor talking to you. And thank you. Thank you for knowing Taiwan, of this bridge of friendship between New Zealand and Taiwan. No, we thank you.
You are fantastic. Thank you for that.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.